request. I am finally getting around to trying to give you my recollection of the events and happenings in the Ruhr pocket, particularly series of episodes that where we were involved and where we went behind the lines blindfolded at some time and under a white flag at others. One of the areas of difficulty that I have is trying to pinpoint the names of the town. I notice in the 7th Armored Division history that it does make reference to the fact that we took a town by the name of Balve, B-A-L-V-E, on about the 12th of April. It then goes on to say that Task Force Daly attacked northwest from Balve to seize Dielinghofen, D-E-I-L-I-N-G-H-O-F-E-N, and a landing strip. If you recall, we were following Wempel's task force at one point. Wempel turned off to the left, and we were to continue going further east and then turning along that road which paralleled the airport. You might recall that I was very concerned about having the task force travel that road paralleling the airport because the entire landing strip was cleared and it was flanked on the other side by a fairly heavily wooded area. And it would seem to me that it would present a fantastic target to anti-tank guns that might have been set up in that wooded area, shooting across an open airport and catching us on that road. You might recall that I asked our combat command if I could try a different route, and they reluctantly agreed, and that's when we wound up in that heavy wooded area, and which had been, we knew had been traveled by the 99th Division up to a certain point. You might recall that we were on that trail which sort of petered out, and we had to take the tanks into the stream and follow the stream bed up to get around a fairly heavy, impassable wooded area. At that point, we ran into a armored half-track, a German armored half-track, filled with some people, and I was on foot with a rifleman. So I let the half-track go by and subsequently went back and got a squad, and the squad came up and subsequently captured the half-track. All of this had taken a considerable amount of time, and we were getting toward dusk, and we finally approached a little town on the outskirts of the town that we knew was occupied by Germans. My speculation is that that may have been the town of Dielinghofen, but looking at maps of Germany, it apparently was too small to even indicate. You might recall that we set up in a house, and I was had serious trepidations about the security of the area because the little house and the units and the areas that we were occupying were in a valley surrounded by high ground. You might recall that we went into one house which was occupied by Germans, and they didn't seem overly surprised to see us. We had dinner as best we could, set up our outpost, and I remember telling one outpost, the one that was nearest the road leading into the town, that if anything came down the road, that they would have taken under fire because it couldn't possibly be one of our vehicles. We slept somewhat restlessly that night, and if you recall, I started early in the morning to try to get permission to move into the town, as it was quite misty and foggy, and I felt that that would give us a considerable amount of cover, and they kept telling me that we couldn't go because the 99th Division on our left flank wasn't quite ready to proceed to their objective. In any case, I went out in the early morning and checked with the outpost that was nearest the town, and lo and behold, sentry on post said that a track vehicle of some kind had come down that road, and he yelled halt, and the vehicle stopped, subsequently backed up, made a V-type turn, and went back into the direction from whence he had come. I asked him why he didn't shoot, and he said that he wasn't sure because nobody answered in German, and of course the word halt, which he used, sounds the same in German and in English. Anyway, you will recall then that we made our way into town and then found that the Air Force personnel that was stationed in that village were having breakfast, and we were able to capture a good number of them at the breakfast table. As we proceeded into town, the road that we were originally supposed to travel on was guarded by a German tank, and the crew was working on the back of the tank and on the side, and I recall distinctly getting one of our tanks up and pointing it out and directing the tank, the fire on the tank, which on the German tank, which they subsequently did and blew it up. We then occupied some areas along the edge, fairly near to the edge of the airfield, and I think you referred to this episode in one of your conversations with me. One of our people had been shot, and every time we tried to recover him or rescue him, we were shot upon by the Germans. I also remember distinctly the fact that we were taking some direct fire from across the airfield of a very, very high velocity, seemingly heavier than 88 fire, and it was direct. It wasn't indirect fire. And when we submitted our shell reps back to combat command, they were asking about, what's bigger than an 88 that can give you direct fire? Obviously, we didn't know, but we subsequently found out that they had tanks with guns mounted on them that were 105 millimeter, and they were never able to get them out of the rear pocket because we had closed it off before they had the chance to. They were made in the rear pocket and never had a chance to get them out and put them into combat other than firing at us across that airport. While we're in that area, we noticed a vehicle come across the airfield under a white flag, and they subsequently stopped, and they yelled that one of our comrades had been shot, and we told them that every time we tried to evacuate him, that someone would shoot at us, and they were glad to help us get the individual in. Their concern was that there was a prisoner of war camp in the town across the airfield, and the name of that one escapes me. And you will recall that they wanted to have that camp taken over by us. They were fearful that the Russians would break out and just decimate the countryside. We didn't know how bad conditions were there, and we subsequently agreed to go across. You might recall, and I'm a little hazy on this, I don't know whether you went over with me at the very beginning. I know you were there, but I don't know whether you went across the open airfield with somebody from the adjacent town firing on us or not. In any case, it was sort of a hairy ride across the airfield, and we subsequently got into the prisoner of war camp, and they had some, as I remember, 23,000 prisoners of war, most of whom were German, excuse me, most of whom were Russians, some few French, and a very few English, Americans, one of whom I remember coming up to us and introducing himself as a Major Waters from the 99th Division, who had been captured just 2 weeks before. I asked Waters how he was treated, and he stated that he was being treated as well as the German guards were, which was not very good, but that the Russians were being systematically starved off at the rate of about 80 a day. And looking at the conditions of the Russians, they couldn't have been in any worse condition if they had been in a concentration camp, skin and bones and unable to get up off the floor. I then went into the commandant's office, who was a cocky little son of a bitch, and told him that we would not take over that camp, or that prisoner of war camp, until we had some assurance that we would not be fired upon coming across the airfield. That led to another long series of events, which I'll try to detail for you. You'll recall then that, excuse me, he couldn't give any guarantee that the firing would stop if he would attempt to bring people across the airfield, because the town, and I guess the town was probably the one that you might have referred to at one time as Hemer, H-E-M-E-R. That seems to have been the nearest good-sized town. And that was occupied by a Panzer unit, according to the commandant of the prisoner of war camp. You'll recall then that I left you in charge of the prisoner of war camp, and I proceeded in to the town to try to find the commanding officer of the unit occupying the town, and apparently the one doing the firing on us when we came across the airfield, despite the fact that we came across under a white flag. Subsequently found the commandant of a tank unit. He was a major, headquartered in a house, billeted in a house in the town. I remember that he had a couple of young, good-looking gals there, and I was saying to myself, this is the way to fight a war. Even though you might have to lose it, you might just as well lose it with some female companionship. He took a dislike to me. Here I was, a major in the American Armed Forces, and he was a German and a major in the German Armed Forces. And it was something that we could immediately sense that there was a dislike for each other. And of course, we were trying to talk with interpreters, and somehow or other these things lose something in its in their translation. In any case, he said he didn't have the authority to grant us permission to come across, regardless of what the commandant of the prisoner of war camp wanted, and that the only one that could give permission for that would be division headquarters, that was located a short distance away. And he suggested that I go back and see the people at division headquarters, which I subsequently did. They blindfolded me, put me in my own Jeep with one of their drivers, and we took off to try to locate the division headquarters, which we subsequently found out that was in the process of moving, so that instead of it being a fairly close by distance, it was a fairly substantial distance that we traveled. Anyway, we arrived at a certain point, and they stopped the Jeep and took my blindfold off. And there was sort of a rustic-type hut in the middle of an open field, and I was escorted over a fence and to that particular hut, at which point several German officers subsequently appeared, and we started a talk. Um, I recall that it was I was unable, before I left the original town, to make contact with our unit to advise them that I was going back to try to make contact with the German division headquarters. So I just took off and assumed that I'd be back fairly quickly. This leads to a problem in the future when I subsequently and quite a while later on did return. In any case, the Germans that appeared on the scene were of lower level rank. I think the senior person, the highest rank being a lieutenant colonel. There were a couple of junior officers that spoke perfect English. In fact, I recall one had spent some time in the States being educated. After much conversation back and forth, which really reached little or no conclusions, they being unable to make any decisions, and me keeping on saying that, you know, the war is lost for you guys, why don't you be smart and save a lot of lives by surrendering, as they had been alluding to it. They assured me that in the German army, you simply did not talk about surrendering, because there were many diehard fanatics that simply would not accept the fact that the war was practically lost and was certainly coming to a rapid end. Finally, a general officer came in, and I asked his name, and he refused to give me his name, but I noticed that he had an insignia on the side of his cap, which appeared to be a running greyhound in a little silver pin form. In the course of the conversation, I mentioned to the interpreter that I had read in the Stars and Stripes that General Modell, who had been in command of the Ruhr Pocket, had flown out. He said something in German which I didn't understand. I asked the interpreter what he said, because he was smiling when he said it, and the interpreter said that the general said that he didn't know whether Modell flew out, but he would rather be where Modell was than where he was at the present time. In any case, excuse me, we talked for some period of time and finally decided that neither they nor we could really come to any definitive conclusions in terms of surrendering, but that they would send back an emissary with me to make contact with our division headquarters personnel. At this point, they furnished me with a lieutenant colonel that I was to bring back to our division headquarters. We had a ride back, and while I was blindfolded, this time I was able to have the blindfold positioned in such a way that I was able to see what was happening in the area I was being driven by. And I could see that there was a great exodus of vehicles streaming back from the area that we had first come. They were retreating and in a fairly orderly fashion. The Germans, of course, that were in the vehicle with me were not aware that I could see. And the thought occurred to me that could they possibly be playing for time in order to assure themselves that there'd be no firing on their area while I was back there. This gave me cause for concern. However, this cause for concern was eliminated fairly quickly, because as we entered the town from which I had originally started, our units were firing white phosphorus. The radio that I had in the Jeep was unable to reach anybody, but fortunately we had a half-track with a more powerful radio in the town, And I think, Bruce, if I recall, you were at the location of the half track. Again, I'm a little hazy on that. In any case, we were able to subsequently make contact with our own forces and have them discontinue firing, at least while I was still in the town. We then proceeded with the Lieutenant Colonel emissary from the Germans back to our division headquarters, Forward CP. At this point, they knew that we were on our way back. So the Forward CP contained quite a few people, including the senior officer, who was Jack Ryan, the then chief of staff, as I remember the situation. It took us a considerable amount of time to get from where our own unit was back to where division headquarters Forward CP was. By the time I arrived, they were all ready, and they brought in the German Lieutenant Colonel with me, and he explained that while they were ready to surrender, these things took time, and he wanted to have an area declared as an open city so there'd be no combat. Obviously, he was stalling for time, and again went on to indicate that you simply did not throw in the sponge and quit, or you might not survive the procedure with the fanatical people that still remained in the German army and were not ready to give up under any set of circumstances. The enlisted personnel were looking in the windows and were finding this to be of tremendous interest. First of all, they knew something of somewhat monumental proportion was happening, and in addition, they were able to see a real-life German lieutenant colonel up close, not dead. The intelligence personnel from division were at the Forward CP, and I immediately told the G2 section that the general that we had talked to was an individual assigned to some unit that had a running greyhound as part of their insignia. They looked up the order of battle, and he came back and he said that the general was obviously General von Valkenburg, as I recall, and I think the 7th Armored Division history calls him von Waldenburg, but I'm sure it was that they were incorrect in that instance. They said he commanded the 116th Panzer Grenadiers, which we subsequently found out that that was an accurate appraisal of the situation. I got this distinct impression at this point that Jack Ryan was putting on a big act. First, he tried to disarm the German general, the German lieutenant colonel. Secondly, he tried to get the German general to salute with a non-Nazi, you know, arm-raised type of salute. And I thought this was just a show for the onlookers rather than really an intent to intimidate the lieutenant colonel. I told Ryan that when I was behind the German lines, that I had not been disarmed, and I saw no reason for the German lieutenant colonel to be disarmed. He was not making any gesture, being outnumbered by about 150 to 1. Ryan had a great deal of impatience, and he told the German lieutenant colonel that if he would give him 2 hours, which at which time, if they did not get an unconditional surrender, that they would be attacked with all the might of the United States Army, consisting of tanks and infantry and planes and everything possible would be thrown at the enemy. He looked at me and said, 2 hours, it's impossible. it will take me longer than that to get back to where we had started out from. And I told Ryan that this was an accurate appraisal, that it had taken us well over 2 hours to get there. And now we had that amount of time to get back. And then on top of that, that would almost presume that he would get an immediate answer. In any case, the meeting was fruitless. The German lieutenant colonel was very, very disappointed, as was I. And he looked at me and apologized. He said, well, he said, all I can say is that we did our best to save some lives, he said, which obviously will there'll be some action later on, and there'll be people wounded and killed. Of course, that was a very accurate appraisal of the situation. I was more than a little pissed at Ryan, but there wasn't much I could do about it, except that I kept building up a head of steam. And when I finally got back and the German lieutenant colonel took off back to his own unit, I was still seething, and the attack order had come down from division headquarters to the combat command, and Colonel Triplett came over to me and he said, I want you to attack in this direction. And I said, I'm not going into that town with any troops. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, Colonel, I said, I've been in there since early this morning. And I said, I'll be goddamned if I'm going to go back in there again and get my ass shot off when there was no need to make that decision to start out with. And he said, you're bordering on insubordination. And I said, well, so be it. I said, I'm just not going to lead this unit into that town, regardless of what you say. He said, will you support it by fire from your present location? And I said, sure, we'll turn the tanks and face the town while some other people go in. And I said, but I'm not going to take my unit in there. He was pissed about my answer and my attitude, except that I think he really sensed and knew why I felt the way I did. Anyway, the attack took place, as you recall, and it wasn't much of an action, although there were some wounded, and I'm sure there were probably some killed on the German side. And finally, that town was taken for whatever purposes, I don't know. The Germans had pretty well vacated it, and I think they were sort of fighting a rear guard action. While we were gone, Wemple had sent a light tank company or a platoon of light tanks to secure the prisoner of war camp, and I guess from what I heard, a couple of the tanks had literally ridden over the fence and knocked it down, and of course that was the worst thing they could possibly have done, because now instead of securing the camp and keeping the prisoners intact, the prisoners just streamed out looking for food to eat. The Germans had worried about them violating the women in the town and killing people, and of course they were in such bad shape physically that all they concerned themselves was with getting something to eat. I remember one Russian prisoner eating a can of DDT, not knowing what it was. I remember a couple taking chunks of a dead horse who had been buried, and then the stomach distended above ground level with gases, and they were trying to chop off pieces of that to get some food. It was a pretty horrible sight. As you then know, that while the division history is somewhat at a variance with my recollection of the situation, the Germans, having found out what they did in our area of operation, went up on our northern flank and made contact with another unit, I think, that was assigned to us, and subsequently the entire Ruhr pocket just caved in at that point. And that was the end of the Ruhr. I often thought that we could have been the heroes by having that surrender take place if he had just simply given that individual from the German side a little more time to get back, and possibly even to the point of sending somebody of a higher level back to negotiate the whatever peace terms had to be negotiated. I really think that they just needed time to think the thing over and see the thing start to collapse the way it was. They knew that any future fighting effort was ludicrous and that it would simply serve no purpose. The fighting, generally speaking, was over as early as that morning when we went into the town, for all practical purposes. That's pretty much my recollection, except that I remember one other thing, and that was that Triplett came down a couple of days later and to the unit, and I said something about, I'm going to transfer to military government. And he said, you're still hot about that little episode. And I said, I'm more than hot. I'm dead serious. He said, no. He said, I won't accept your request for transfer unless you submit it 2 weeks from now and you feel the same way. He said, you'll get over it. He said, not everything goes the way we want it to go in times of combat. So I guess that was true. I never did apply. Bruce, that's pretty much my recollection of the episode. I wish I could be more helpful in terms of the towns. I even went to the public library and got a bigger map than I found available through the Auto Club, International Travel Service. It was a fairly detailed map, and yet I couldn't find any of the towns that was referred to in the 7th Armored Division history. You had mentioned at one point that you had an after-action report about the Ruhr, so that you well may be able to make a better case for time and places than I'm able to do after, I don't know, 45 years or so later. It was a great experience. It's just too bad that I didn't make notes at that point. But then, you know, you never think that it's going to be of that consequence. They make a brief reference to the fact that I went behind the lines to negotiate the peaceful takeover of that town in the division history, but there was no detail whatsoever. And of course, I always felt that the most interesting aspect of it was the fact that we went back and wound up talking to General von Valkenburg, who I guess was one of their better known generals, and the division being one of their better known divisions. So much for that. I'm also sending with this tape a copy of the after action report, which I referred to in our meeting at the reunion. It doesn't cover the Ruhr Pocket, but it covers the period of December, which you will recall vividly had to do with the St. Vith and the Bulge operation. You will probably find it to be of interest. There's one page that obviously is bad in that, I guess, Deutsch, when he typed it or had it typed, the carbon was twisted or something, and you'll find one bad page. The quality of the photocopy of the various pages is not the best, but you can make it out if you concentrate, and I think you'll find it to be of interest. You had also mentioned that you had the after-action report about the action in the Ruhr, and I would appreciate it if you would send that to me. If you find after listening to this summary, and you can live through the boredom, and you want, you know, to jog my memory or ask me other questions, I'll be glad to try to answer them and you know do it on another tape or do it over the phone, or if it doesn't take forever, I could even type it up. My typing skills are not very good, and it would have taken me several days with thousands of errors to put this on paper. So your suggestion that I could do it on tape was a good one. And I hope it's of some interest to you and gives you what you want. I'm sure there are things that I've overlooked and episodes that I should have remembered, but my 70, almost 71-year-old brain probably isn't quite as sharp as it was 45 years ago. Hope this is what you wanted, Bruce. So long.